From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
She was shot in the stomach and the foot, so I found her in the hospital with one of her sons in quite a state, and she was shot the 10th, which was during the ceasefire.
Massacre in Fallujah. 600 dead, 1,000 wounded, 60,000 refugees. We'll go to Iraq to get a report from Free Speech Radio News' Aaron Glantz. Here in the United States, a judge orders the release of Palestinian activist Farouk Abdelmouti.
My name is Farouk Abdelmouti. I am coordinator of Palestinian National Alliance.
Farouk Abdelmouti has spent almost 2 years in jail, never been charged with a crime. We'll speak with his lawyer. And we go to Haiti, a month after President Aristide is overthrown in what he calls a modern kidnapping in the service of a coup backed by the United States. Corpses are piling up. We'll speak with a U.S. attorney who recently returned from Haiti. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the death toll from the U.S. siege on Fallujah has now topped 600. Over 1,200 more Iraqis have been injured. On Friday, 60,000 women and children fled the city during a brief ceasefire, but the U.S. blocked any men of military age from leaving. The U.S. claims there's a ceasefire in the city to allow for political negotiations to take place, but other reports from Iraq indicate there is no ceasefire. Dozens of bodies have been buried in the city's soccer stadium after U.S. forces blocked roads heading toward the cemetery. According to the Guardian of London, local hospitals reported the majority of the dead are women, children, and the elderly, but the U.S. maintains 95% of those killed are members of the resistance. The attack on Fallujah has galvanized major portions of the Iraqi population against the United States. Even the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council appears to be in danger of collapsing. One member suspended his seat on the council to protest the U.S. actions. Four more have threatened to quit. And one of the Iraqis closest to the United States, Adnan Pachachi, charged the U.S. actions in Fallujah are, quote, unacceptable and illegal. The U.S. initially blocked members of the Iraqi Governing Council from entering Fallujah. The council members were attempting to start negotiations. Council member Hashim Hassani said the U.S. has alienated much of the Iraqi population. He said, quote, if you keep shooting them, you're gaining more enemies, not just in Fallujah, but all over Iraq, and then you cannot have democracy. In addition, the newly installed Iraqi Minister of Human Rights resigned in protest, and there are reports that many governmental workers are on strike to protest the U.S. actions in Fallujah. And the London Telegraph is reporting senior British Army officials are growing more concerned over U.S. actions in Iraq. One official told the paper, quote, my view and the view of the British chain of command is that the Americans' use of violence is not proportionate and is over-responsive to the threat they are facing. They don't see the Iraqi people the way we see them. They view them as Untermenschen or subhumans. They are not concerned about the Iraqi loss of life in the way the British are, unquote. The official went on to say, quote, the U.S. will have to abandon the sledgehammer to crack a nut approach. It has failed. They need to stop viewing every Iraqi, every Arab as the enemy and attempt to win the hearts and minds of the people, he said. Fighting continued to rage through several other Iraqi cities over the weekend, including Baquba, where U.S. forces killed 47 Iraqis. President Bush reiterated Sunday the U.S. still plans to hand over power on June 30th, but it remains unclear who the power will be handed to. When asked on Sunday what kind of Iraqi government would take over in July, the head of the U.S. occupation, Paul Bremer, said, quote, that's a good question. The Los Angeles Times reports the continuing violence has brought to a virtual halt U.S. reconstruction efforts and work toward the planned June 30th transition to Iraqi sovereignty. President Bush described the resistance as, quote, a few people trying to stop progress toward democracy. But nearly all evidence coming out of Iraq indicates much of the population, even the U.S.-trained Iraqi army, have turned against the occupying forces. The Washington Post reports an entire battalion of the U.S.-trained Iraqi army refused orders to fight in Fallujah against the Iraqi resistance. One soldier told reporters, quote, "We didn't sign up to fight Iraqis." Some members of the army reportedly quit to join the resistance. Britain's Foreign Minister Jack Straw admitted to the BBC that the resistance is widespread. Straw said, quote, "The lid of the pressure cooker has come off. It's plainly the fact today that there are larger numbers of people, and they are people on the ground, Iraqis, not foreign fighters, who are engaged in this insurgency." A new Newsweek poll has found 64% of Americans are concerned Iraq will turn into another Vietnam. Overall, at least 60 U.S. troops have died over the past week, including 19 since Friday. Two died yesterday when their Apache helicopter was shot down near the Baghdad airport. Over 750 coalition troops have now died since the U.S. invasion, about 665 from the U.S. and 100 from other members of the coalition, including nearly 60 from Britain. At least 10 civilian hostages are also being held by various groups within the Iraqi resistance. The hostages include three Japanese civilians who have been held since Wednesday, one of them there to investigate the effects of depleted uranium, seven Chinese civilians who were taken Sunday, and an American working for the Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root. He was abducted on a road after the truck he was driving was attacked by insurgents. An Australian camera crew filmed him being taken away by armed men wearing traditional Iraqi headdress. In Japan, the news of the hostages has been the country's top story for much of the past week. Being held are an 18-year-old who traveled to Iraq to study the effects of DU, a 32-year-old freelance journalist, and a 34-year-old aid worker. On Saturday, Al Jazeera received a fax statement that said the three hostages would be released within 24 hours, but they're still being held, leading to increased calls for the Japanese to pull its troops from Iraq. Vice President Dick Cheney is traveling to Japan and South Korea on a previously scheduled trip, in part to urge the countries to remain with the United States in Iraq. Cheney will also be visiting China. And Friday marked the first anniversary of the fall of Baghdad and the day U.S. troops pulled down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Firdaus Square in Baghdad. But there was no celebration at the former site of Saddam's statue. On Friday, the Los Angeles Times reports the square was sealed off by U.S. troops with armored vehicles. Soldiers removed large posters of the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who the U.S. has labeled an outlaw. In the square, the U.S. troops were broadcasting a message in Arabic warning that anyone who approached the square would be shot. On Saturday, the White House released a once top secret memo that warned President Bush some 36 days before the September 11th attacks that al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden was determined to strike inside the United States. The memo reported that the FBI had found, quote, patterns of suspicious activity in this country consistent with preparations for hijackings or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. The memo also states that the FBI was conducting 70 full-field investigations connected to bin Laden throughout the country. The report was declassified 2 days after National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice claimed the August 6 presidential daily briefing was a, quote, historical memo that did not merit special action. Bush received the briefing at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, on August 6, 2001, where he continued to vacation. On Sunday, Bush, on another trip to Texas, defended his administration's handling of the al-Qaeda pre-911 threat. He said, quote, "I am satisfied that I never saw any intelligence that indicated there was going to be an attack on America at a time and a place an attack." Meanwhile, the New York Times reports some Republicans are now openly questioning whether the GOP made a major political mistake in selecting New York City, the site of the attacks, to hold the party's convention this summer. The convention is set to begin just 2 weeks before the third anniversary of the September 11th attacks. On Tuesday, the Independent 9/11 Commission will begin two more days of hearings. Set to testify Tuesday are former FBI Director Louis Freeh and Attorney General John Ashcroft. This is Democracy Now!, John Coltrane's Spiritual. I'm Amy Goodman. The northern Iraqi town of Fallujah is under siege. There are reports of a massacre at the hands of U.S. troops. The death toll in the town has now topped 600, with over 1,000 injured. Local hospitals report the majority of the dead are women, children, and the elderly. The U.S. maintains 95% of those killed are members of the resistance. We go directly to Iraq with Free Speech Radio News' Aaron Glantz. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
We are about to go to a piece that you have just filed with us. Can you set it up for us and tell us the latest news right now?
Well, the best that I can ascertain is that everywhere I look on the mainstream media, they're talking about a ceasefire, a calm settled over Fallujah. And while I haven't been in Fallujah today, I've been talking to people who have fled Fallujah and who have been to Fallujah during this so-called ceasefire. And they report that whenever they go out of their homes, they're at risk of being hit by snipers of U.S. Marines on bridges and on top of buildings. And, of course, the Americans are fighting a guerrilla war against an increasingly violent resistance amongst the regular people of Fallujah. So for the Marines, every single member of the population of Fallujah is a potential enemy, because almost the entire population is against the Americans. And those who were not against it a week ago have now changed their minds, because they've had their daughters and their sons and their mothers and their children shot and killed or maimed in some way. So we're going to be able to go to the Fallujah through the voices of some of those who fled, as well as the voices of one journalist who risked her life in order to get us the material to broadcast today.
Aaron Glantz talking to us from Baghdad as we go to his report on Fallujah.
The story of Yusuf Fakhri Amash is the story of Fallujah. The 11-year-old boy just escaped from Fallujah with his family, but not before the U.S. military killed his best friend.
Ahmed was in my class. He was younger than me. He was standing next to the wall of the secondary school. He was trying to cross the road and he was hit by a bullet. The American troops fired the bullet.
11-year-old Yusuf Fakhri Amash takes issue with claims from George Bush the American army is fighting, quote, a small band of thugs.
America is the enemy of the children. Americans shoot us on the street. They even bombed our school. We are innocent kids. We can't play on the street because of the Americans.
Over the weekend, with more than 600 of Fallujah's residents dead and thousands injured, U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer declared a unilateral ceasefire in Fallujah and said the Americans wanted to give women and children of Fallujah a chance to flee the city. But U.S. military snipers remain on rooftops and bridges, and the Marines' theater commander declared his troops retain their right to defend themselves. The result, scenes like this one. This footage was taken by independent filmmaker Julia Guest, one of the few Western journalists who's gained access to Fallujah since the siege began. She accompanied a team bringing medical supplies into Fallujah Saturday during the ceasefire. The picture accompanying these sounds is of an old woman in a hospital bed, a U.S. Marine's sniper bullet in her neck. Clinic director Meki Al-Azhar.
They say there is a ceasefire. They said 12 o'clock. People went out to do some shopping. Everybody who went out was shot, and this place was full, and half of them were dead. I don't know why. Please, you do your best to ask them why.
Julia Guest describes one of those shot during the ceasefire.
When I arrived, I found a woman who I think was in her 70s who had decided to try and help her sons get out of the city. They decided to leave as a family group. And so she'd just taken the decision to walk out of her front door waving a white flag because they knew they were in a very heavily... There was a lot of shooting in their area. And she was shot in the stomach and the foot, so... I found her in the hospital with one of her sons in quite a state, and she was evacuated in a small van that had volunteered to come out from Baghdad and picked her up and took her back to Baghdad.
What day was she shot?
She was shot the 10th, which was during the ceasefire.
Filmmaker Julia Guest says the clinic's ambulance was shot twice by American snipers, also during the ceasefire. The second time the ambulance was shot, it was carrying American and British citizens who had negotiated an agreement with the Marines to rescue the injured from an area with heavy U.S. sniper fire.
Now, it has blue sirens. It was donated from the Kingdom of Spain. It's very clearly an ambulance. It's carrying oxygen bottles. And the damage to the ambulance was such that two of the wheels are totally wrecked on it now as well. So they were left without an ambulance after that. And there are bullet holes in the side of the ambulance from the second shooting. And other bits and pieces, you see small bullet holes all over the place for this ambulance.
Today, there are no television cameras in Fallujah broadcasting breaking news to the outside. The crew of the Arab satellite channel Al Jazeera, which had broadcast images of dead women and children and the use of American cluster bombs, was evacuated from the city over the weekend.
The response, the American response to Al Jazeera coverage is simple. They don't want any witness. They want to do their job behind the scene without the world knowing what's going on.
Al Jazeera senior producer Samir Khader, I spoke with him in Baghdad.
The response, the American response to Al Jazeera coverage is simple. They don't want any witness. They want to do their job behind the scene without the world knowing what's going on. They wanted to take over Fallujah the American way, harshly, militarily, using all the force at their disposal, and that's it.
So what have they done to try to keep people from knowing, at least through your channel?
First of all, they were surprised to discover that we are present in Fallujah. And for us, it was by chance, because one of our reporters, one of our crews, was in Fallujah several days before the start of the attack, just to interview some people there and to interview them about the incident of killing the Americans in the streets of Fallujah. And by chance, the Americans, first of all, they asked us if we want to send a reporter to be embedded with the American forces that will try to attack Fallujah, and we said, no, thank you. And they went on Fallujah, and by chance our crew was there, and the crew was unable to get out of the city, and the Americans were surprised to find us there.
The images that Al Jazeera has been broadcasting from Fallujah have been extremely graphic. Can you describe some of them for people who are in America and have not seen any of them?
Anybody who served in the army knows what's the job of an army, is to wage war. The images that we received from our crew in Fallujah live on Al Jazeera were images of a true war, a war between two armies. But the problem here is that there were no armies, only the American army, and no Iraqi army to fight, only civilians. Civilians and some insurgents, a limited number of insurgents. And what the Americans pretend is that this is a tiny minority in Fallujah fighting the Americans. But what we have seen and heard on these pictures is that the whole population of Fallujah was against the Americans. Therefore, what we have seen, F-16s, Black Hawk helicopters pounding the city indiscriminately, killing a huge number of children and women. And the latest information that we got from the city is that the loss amongst the insurgents is very low, very, very low, which means that the Americans targeted the city, as I said, indiscriminately, pounding the civilian areas and killing children and women. And this is no war.
You're saying that the bodies that we see, the maybe 500 dead, something about that, and thousands of injured, how can you know that they're not the insurgents? Because, of course, there's a guerrilla war that's happening. So how do you differentiate that?
I'm not saying. The Americans are saying. The Americans indirectly are saying that these killed people are civilians. You know how? Because they say this is a small bunch of insurgents, a tiny minority. If you have 500 bodies on the streets, if all these bodies were bodies of insurgents, that means that the whole city is against the Americans, are insurgents, the whole city. The Americans say this is a tiny minority. Is 500 corpses a tiny minority if all of them are insurgents?
You've had to evacuate your crew from Fallujah, is that right?
We have evacuated the main crew, yes. But we left behind three of the crew who are natives of Fallujah. They don't want to leave because their families are there. So we left them with a camera and a satellite phone, and they are still reporting from there. And we asked them to retreat, and they said, no, sorry, this is our city, our people, our families.
The people of Fallujah have fought hard, and the American invasion of Fallujah is causing a violent backlash. Gunfire, an ambulance rushes to the scene as an American tank burns on the main road to Fallujah. Every day, more Iraqis take up arms against the occupation, disgusted at mounting civilian casualties in Fallujah and the south of Iraq, where U.S. military is fighting the Mehdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr. Ibrahim Hassan is 40 years old. He fled the city with his wife and three children on Friday. An American bomb had destroyed his neighbor's house and killed three people inside, but the final straw was when he was shot by snipers during the ceasefire as he went to get food aid from a neighborhood mosque.
I went to the market to bring some food for the kids because we were running out of food. They announced in the mosques there is some food, so we should come and get it. When I went out to the mosque to bring food for the people who didn't have it, it was between 8 and 9 in the morning. The Americans told us we could go out from 6 in the morning until 6 in the afternoon, but it was a big lie. At any time, they're ready to shoot. The bridge was at my back. It was about 300 yards from the bridge. I felt a gunshot above my head. I'm a civilian man. There were a lot of children around, including my children. When I entered the road, they shot us with explosive dum-dum bullets, so I was wounded below my collarbone and in my head and then my stomach.
Now, for the first time, Ibrahim Hassan says he's going to pick up a gun and fight the Americans.
Aaron Glantz, reporting from Iraq. Aaron Glantz of Free Speech Radio News. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Vice President Dick Cheney was in Japan today, where he told Japanese Prime Minister that he was doing the right thing by resisting mounting political pressure and keeping Japanese troops in Iraq, despite shock over the kidnapping of three Japanese civilians. In Japan, the news of the hostages has been the country's top story for much of the past week. Being held are an 18-year-old who traveled to Iraq to study the effects of depleted uranium, a 32-year-old freelance journalist, and a 34-year-old aid worker. On Saturday, Al Jazeera received a fax statement that said the three hostages would be released within 24 hours. But they are still being held, leading to increased calls for the Japanese to pull the troops from Iraq. There have been large demonstrations in Japan protesting the country's participation in the Iraq occupation. We go now to Tokyo. Yo Ijichi is an international coordinator of Peace Boat, a Japan-based NGO focusing on peace education and advocacy started by Japanese university students some 20 years ago. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Talk about who is being held in Japan and who's being held in Iraq and the reaction in Japan?
Basically, the three hostages, Mr. Imai, Ms. Takato, and Mr. Koriyama, have been three citizens that were well known in Japan for their continuous work against the Japanese government regarding the Iraqi issue, for them to not send any troops to Iraq, as well as they have been constantly active on reporting the current situation of what Iraq is in the impact of depleted uranium, as well as the activity with the orphans in Iraq. And it was a very big shock for us to hear that these three people were taken as hostage, since they were the people that have been working on humanitarian aid on civil society's movement. And it was a very big shock for us.
One of the three, as you said, the 18-year-old, he's 18 years old, and he went to Iraq to study depleted uranium. In this country, not a lot of people know about depleted uranium.
Yes.
My co-host on Democracy Now!, Juan Gonzalez, did an explosive exposé this week on the DU-contaminated U.S. soldiers returning home. But can you tell us his story?
Well, he is 18 years old. He just graduated from high school, and he was active in students' movement regarding depleted uranium in a city called Sapporo. It's one of the major cities in northern Japan. And he started his own organization regarding depleted uranium, and he went to investigate the impact in the current Iraqi people, and he was planning to try to make a book for children, an easy-to-read book on discussing about depleted uranium and trying to convince the Japanese to be more emphasized on being an anti-nuclear state in the world.
Can you talk about the connection between the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the first atomic bombs ever dropped, and this debate that went on even as the decision was being made to send soldiers, Japan sending troops for the first time since World War II to Iraq?
Well, depleted uranium itself is a very sensitive issue in Japan because of the experience in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is sort of like our symbol of what we have to fight against to achieve peace. And we have been working for a very long time in the past decades as Japanese. But now, because of the threat starting from around Kosovo and also in Iraq, you see the United States using usable mini nukes and depleted uranium, and it's sort of like for young Japanese as well as elder Japanese that are sensitive to the nuclear bombing issue, it's sort of like it is more like for us to this is something that we cannot ignore, and at the same time for Japanese to remain an anti-nuclear nation, we have to fight very strongly against the nuclear issue, especially the depleted uranium, and he was a very active youth in that region.
Ioijichi is International Coordinator of Peace Boat. What exactly is the reaction right now in Japan, and how has it shifted? I mean, things are very explosive. I remember seeing months ago in the whole debate over whether to send troops to Iraq an actual battle on the floor of the Japanese parliament.
Yes. Initially, when the Japanese started the consideration of trying to send the SDF, the self-defense forces, there was a large reaction to that, and majority of the Japanese opposed. And at the moment, due to the hostage issue, now the agency news in Japan are telling that the people are more against having the SDF remaining inside Iraq. And there has been asking people's questions inside the city, and more citizens are becoming more negative on having the self-defense forces remaining in Iraq. Regardless of the hostage issue, they have a negative impression now.
What about the visit of Vice President Dick Cheney? How is that being received, both by the government of Japan and the people?
It was initially known, we knew like around 1 month ago that Dick Cheney was coming, and now that he is here, we were expecting from the civil movement as well to discuss regarding the Iraqi issue. But now, as he is here, it's sort of like now become a campaign for him to just justify the dispatch of troops from the U.S. and Japan to Iraq. And it was sort of like a governmental campaign based on United States and Japan towards the citizen from both. And it's obvious that we also do not agree on having United States sending troops to Iraq as well.
So what is the latest news you have of the three Japanese hostages?
After they declared that they will release them, the hostage, in 24 hours, it's already now nearly 10 hours have passed, and we still haven't heard any news that they have been released. We have one staff at Al Jazeera right now in the headquarters, and he is continuously trying to get new information, and still we have not received any information that the actual release is happening right now.
And Peace Boat, what are its plans?
Sorry?
Peace Boat, your organization, what are your plans right now?
At the moment, as soon as the incident happened, the Japanese civil society movements, including Peace Boat, as well as many of the journalists that have visited Iraq, got together, and they've collected a lot of information regarding the three, including a lot of video footage and also their family images. And one of our staff has now been in Al Jazeera, and he has been repeatedly holding all these information regarding the three hostage on air in Al Jazeera. And we hope that this information that is being spread by Al Jazeera would give some impact on the people that have been taking the hostage, and also to the society inside Iraq to gain more opinion that these three hostages should be released.
Do you think that there's any chance the Prime Minister will pull the Japanese troops from Iraq?
At the moment, no. It seems like the government is becoming more and more stubborn, as if saying that the sending back the troops now from Iraq is being defeated by the terrorists, which is something that a nation should absolutely not do. And that is the campaign that they have been holding for the last 2 days, trying to justify that the necessity of the troops is there and that they cannot lose against these terrorists right now.
I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Io Ijichi, International Coordinator of Peace Boat, the Japan-based NGO focusing on peace education and advocacy. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. We're also video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. And also want to let people know about the beginning of the exception to the ruler's tour around the country as we support community media around the country. We kick off tomorrow here in New York at Cooper Union. And that's at Astor Place, and a reception and an event with Tim Robbins and Juan Gonzalez and WBAI's Bernard White. And we'll be showing Hudson Mohawk Indie Media produced independent media in a time of war. And we'll be talking about dissent and independent media in this country. And I hope you join us, and you can call for reservations and tickets or just show up at the door, but reservations for the reception here at Democracy Now! At 212-431-9090. It's a fundraiser for WBAI, 212-431-9090. Back in a minute. Rat Race here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. Bob Marley. I'm Amy Goodman. The Northern, we're going to talk now about the situation in Haiti. It's been little over a month since Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was ousted in what he called a modern-day kidnapping in the service of a coup d'etat backed by the United States. More U.S. troops were ordered to Haiti within 1 hour of President Aristide's departure, even though President Bush and Secretary of State General Colin Powell had said they would not deploy forces until there was a political solution. Despite the 3,500 U.S.-led troops in the country, the battle for control is still being waged in numerous Haitian towns. The Jamaica Observer is reporting gang leaders and paramilitaries still control large swaths of northern Haiti. They patrol the streets, dispensing their own brand of justice, while hoping to eventually become paid police officers or soldiers in a new Haitian army. Louis-Jodel Chamblain, convicted in absentia for the 94 Rabateau massacre, spends much of his time in Cap-Haïtien with his men, also convicted in absentia of the murder of the Justice Minister Guy Mallory 10 years ago. Most of the men he leads, 20 to 35 years old, have a new long-term objective to serve a new version of the Haitian army. Aristide abolished the army in 1995 as a coup-prone machine responsible for human rights violations. Well, the National Lawyers Guild and several organizations denounced the U.S. government in the forced removal of President Aristide. They demanded a congressional investigation into the role of the U.S. government in the destabilization of the Haitian government and the implementation of the coup, an immediate end to the repression and daily attacks on those demanding the return of President Aristide, as well as support for Haitian refugees. The National Lawyers Guild recently sent a delegation to Haiti to meet with victims and their families. We're joined on the phone now by Tom Griffin, who is part of the delegation. He joins us on the phone from Philadelphia. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Amy.
Can you talk about what you saw?
Yes, I have to say the most compelling thing that we noticed was that the army is back. It's the army that Aristide disbanded in 1994, and because it had historically oppressed the people, they're back and they're doing their thing. They're taking over police stations and dispensing justice as they wish, with an eye towards arresting and even executing people from the supporters of the Lavalas government. What we had done differently than I think a lot of reporters and other groups had done was to go to the Southwest Department, not Cap Haitien or Gonaïves, where we know what's been going on there with Chamblain, but the third largest city in Haiti is called Lacaille, and we were there, and the militaries are there. They're there in the street. They have taken over the police station and basically doing law enforcement. With no prisons working, they tend to execute or I don't know what else. If they don't execute them, I don't know where they'd be holding prisoners. And there's no judges working, so the police are the judges too. I mean, the militaries are the judges also.
We're talking to Tom Griffin, attorney based in Philadelphia, just back from Haiti. Can you talk about the most striking situations you encountered when you were there in dealing with the issue of corpses piling up and finding bodies?
Sure. We had gone to the morgue to check on the amount of bodies that are coming in. And in Port-au-Prince, an inordinate amount of bodies come into the morgue just because people are too poor to pick up their family's dead members or to bury them. But typically the morgue will keep a body for 22 days before it'll dispose of a body. As of February 29th, they claim, this is the morgue director talking, that the motor for the refrigerations broke in the morgue and bodies are now being dumped within 5 to 6 days of arriving. He also told us that normally the morgue doesn't dump and bury any more than 100 bodies in a month. But on March 7th, 1 week after the coup, 800 bodies were dumped by the morgue. And 2 weeks later, another 200 bodies were dumped by the morgue. And the director of the morgue admitted to us that many of the bodies were coming in, had their hands tied behind their backs, and had black plastic bags over their heads and had been shot. We had also heard from different groups we had interviewed that about 60 bodies were found in a field in Port-au-Prince near a very poor neighborhood, and the group rushed down there to see what we could see, didn't find any bodies where we were told we'd find them, and interviewed some neighbors near the field, and they told us that the bodies had just been moved 2 days before to about a quarter mile away and were burned. So we headed down there and found a massive pile of ashes, pigs eating human flesh off human bones that didn't burn, and interviewed some young men who were in the area too. We took a lot of photographs, and we noticed that the fuel for the fire was a misprinted Haitian currency, which we obviously determined was somehow held, you know, government property was used to burn the bodies.
And who did people say had done this?
No one knew, except big trucks were used to dump and to move the bodies. And we can only, you know, surmise that because of the timing of the events, that it's all post-coup, when Lavalas people are all in hiding, either in the mountains or in city friends' houses in the city, that it's people who can move with impunity and do this kind of thing. So we're assuming that the victims were Lavalas supporters.
We're talking to Tom Griffin with the National Lawyers Guild, just returned from Haiti. We're broadcasting this on Pacifica radio stations around the country, NPR stations, university radio stations, as well as 100 public access TV, PBS, and satellite television stations over Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish Network. And for those who are watching this, we're showing the photographs that Tom took in Haiti, the horrific photographs of the skulls. Are people afraid now in Haiti, and what is their sense of what will happen?
Generally, if you're a Lavalas supporter, you're afraid. We had met with about 30 members of popular organizations, which are just grassroots organizations that formed to basically help neighborhoods and communities to interface with the government and get things done, such as literacy programs and orphanages. And a group of them knew we were in town, came to meet with us. Every single one of them has been in hiding since March 1st, and many of them are not hiding with their families and their children, so they haven't seen their wives or kids for a month. So they're very afraid. Then you have the general population that may not have been actively pro-Lavalas, who are just afraid. There's a curfew in the city of Port-au-Prince, and different curfews for different times throughout the country. But in Port-au-Prince, it's 10 o'clock at night. There's just general tension in the city because of that. There's a super lack of electricity. There never was good electricity in Port-au-Prince, but many neighborhoods have just complete blackouts because of something that happened around the change of government. And without electricity, also, there's no running water in houses that had it because everything's run by electric pump. So there's just general tension. And then that's exacerbated by the presence of U.S. troops and Canadian and French troops who will just randomly patrol streets and go up as if there's a military exercise and just march up and stop traffic, and then all of a sudden just disappear. So no one knows where they're coming from or when they're coming. So there's a general sense of tension. The other thing is I spend a lot of time with students, high school students and college students. No one knows who their current government is. I don't think they ever heard the name La Tortue until he was pushed on them a few weeks ago.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Tom Griffin, for joining us just back from Haiti. Is there any discussion of where President Aristide is? I encourage people to go to our website at democracynow.org to see all of our coverage of what happened to the Aristides, their trip to the Central African Republic, and the documentation of their trip back, brought back by a U.S. delegation, by a delegation led by U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters, and the discussion now, while he is in Jamaica, that he probably will end up in South Africa, Tom. Well, I want to thank you. Tom, is there any discussion of that in Haiti?
Sorry. I hadn't heard anything. Everyone knows that he's in Jamaica, but I hadn't heard of any place he's going to go, and I definitely didn't hear anything about any group trying to bring him back to Haiti anytime soon.
Well, thank you for being with us, Tom Griffin of National Lawyers Guild. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move into our last segment. In Pennsylvania, a federal judge last week ordered the release of prominent Palestinian activist Farouk Abdelmouti. Abdelmouti has been jailed for almost 2 years, even though he has never been charged with a crime. In April of 2002, three New York police officers, an INS agent, all in civilian dress, came to his Queens apartment without a warrant. They claimed they wanted to speak to him, ask him questions about September 11th. They said they believed there were weapons and explosives in the apartment. When Farouk's roommate, Bernard McFall, refused to open the door, they threatened to break it down, entering without a warrant. But Farouk Abdulmuti wasn't home because he was with us at WBAI Radio in New York. He learned of the raid from his son, Tarek, and his roommate, Bernard McFall, who works for the Environmental Protection Agency. After the first raid, we interviewed Farouk Abdulmuti. We're going to play an excerpt of that interview. It was before he was taken. But first, we go to Jeff Fogel, who is Farouk Abdulmuti's attorney, with the latest news of the federal judge ordering his release. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeff Fogel.
Thank you, Amy.
What happened?
Literally what happened was the judge ordered his release. We have been fighting this issue out, as you indicated, for nearly 2 years. The government has done everything it can to delay even getting the issue before a judge. And when we finally got one before her and she looked at the papers, she realized it was a pretty obvious case of misconduct by the government in holding him for such a long time and ordered his release. Forthwith is the word she used.
Okay, so she ordered this on Thursday. Where is he?
Well, that's a good question, because we lost track of him after he left Pennsylvania. He was supposed to have been returned to Hudson County Jail in New Jersey, but turned up in Atlanta. And I'm getting conflicting stories from ICE, the Bureau of Prisons, and the Marshals Service about who was responsible for him being in Atlanta. I don't trust any of them. In any event, we've been negotiating his return as quickly as possible to New York, to the New York area, so that he can be released. The judge ordered that Bice inform her within 10 days of the fact of his release. So presumably that would literally give them up to 10 days, but I don't think they want to go that far.
Jeff Ogle, we're going to take a listen now to what Farouk Abdulmuti had to say right before he was arrested and right before he was taken 2 years ago. Again, the authorities had already raided his apartment. He had been working with us at WBAI, the Pacifica station in New York. He was under tremendous pressure. He came over to Democracy Now! Studios here at the Firehouse, and we talked. This is Farouk Abdulmuti right before his capture.
My name is Farouk Abdulmuti. I am coordinator of Palestinian National Alliance. This morning I have an appointment to come to the radio WBAI in Manhattan. I live in Queens. When I moved from my apartment about 4:30 in the morning, I never know after I be in the program in the house, 8 o'clock, four persons come and knock the door where we live, and the other gentleman who is living in the same apartment, his name Bernard McFall, is open the door and ask him, what can I do for you? He say, we are detectives, and we like to talk to you. And he say, we're looking for Farouk. He say, Farouk left. He say, no, we want to come inside. He make mistake and let the four detectives come inside the apartment and beginning to investigate him. And when one way, talk to him nice, and another way, try to treat him. Include when he say, I don't know where he is, treat him well. If you don't tell me the truth, we're going to throw you from the window. We live in 14th floor. And my son was sleeping. After that, came him up and asked him about me. And after beginning to walk with his shoes over the pillows, over the bed, and beginning to ask to Bernard McFall why we see a lot of pictures here of the Palestinian struggle. Why you have you look like support of the Democratic Front for Liberation of Palestine? He say, you're not, if you want to ask me any question, I have to bring my lawyer. He say, well, if you don't want to ask in this moment what we want to ask, talk to you, we have to take you to the 26 of Federal Plaza. And after come to my son, beginning to investigate with him, and opened his notebook, what had telephones, and beginning to write the telephones, what's in the notebook. According to my son, he don't know if he's opened the computer and looking for other issues in the middle. According to Bernard McFaul, when I speak to him, he say, these people ask if you know Faridom Danish. Faridom Danish is a progressive Pakistani, have more than 40 years, what sympathized with the Palestinian question, was cut up about 2 months ago in 126 on Broadway, when the owner of the restaurant called the police because he's finding his envelope, he have some of the Palestinian martyrs picture. And after the third day, the owner of the restaurant is a Cuban refugee, called the police and the FBI come in and take him to the jail. We work very hard to put a lawyer and get out from the jail. These people come today and ask Bernard if he know about Faridom Danish, but he's never make any criminal, never make anything. The same thing myself or my son or a citizen like Mr. Bernard McFaul, what is employer of the government. He work with the government. When he say, well, I am a city employer, he say, the detective say, I am the same thing, I am a city employer. But the way was his act, the way what his conduct is look like is members of the FBI. And I raise my voice, and I come in here, invited by Democratic Today to be in this program because I have to raise my voice and to rise with the voice of all the people who are coming to be oppressed, especially after 9/11. It looks like the situation is coming more to the right extreme. And we need an appeal to the, all the American people to understand the situations, and together we can defeat is like the people united is never be defeated.
Farouk Abdelmouti, 2 years ago, right before he was taken into custody by the federal authorities. He has been in prison without charge for almost 2 years. A federal judge on Thursday ordered his release. On the line with us, Jeff Vogel, as you listen to this interview, is this unusual? Is Farouk one of the longest-held prisoners? And what does being stateless have to do with this? There was continual threats that he would be deported. What happened?
Yes, well, in 2001, the Supreme Court of the United States decided a case in which they held that you could not keep an alien indefinitely merely because you could not repatriate that person. Now, Farouk sits in a situation that a number of Palestinians do who have been ordered to be deported, which is that Israel will not allow their repatriation. The United States doesn't want to release them from jail, notwithstanding the fact of the Supreme Court decision. So there, in fact, are several hundred people who fit into this category. I don't have a complete breakdown. This is one of the longest ones, and this is very clear in Farouk's case that much of it is a function of Farouk's activism, because this case should have been decided within days after he was held by ICE, that they were not going to be able to repatriate them. They knew it from the start, and they know it now. And it took us almost 2 years, as I said, to get to a federal judge in order to be able to prove it.
Jeff Vogel, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. I want to thank you for being with us, and
Quite
we'll
welcome.
Certainly continue to follow this, Farouk Abdelmouti.
Hopefully he'll be out within days.
And that does it for today's program. For more information, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Again, we start our Exception to the Rulers tour tomorrow night here in New York at Cooper Union. We hope to see everyone. Actor Tim Robbins will be there, WBAI's Bernard White, co-host Juan Gonzalez, my brother David Goodman. We co-wrote the book that we're releasing tomorrow night, The Exception to the Rulers, exposing oily politicians, war profiteers, and the media that love them. Hope to see you there. You can get tickets in advance by calling us here at 212-431-9090. That's 212-431-9090 for the pre-event reception. You can also just show up for the event at 7 o'clock. After that, we head off to Fresno. You can get information for that event, fundraiser for KFCF in Fresno. And on April 15th, we'll be celebrating KPFA's 55th anniversary at King Middle School in Berkeley. Looking forward to seeing you. Democracy Now! Is produced by Sharif Abdo-Kudus, Mike Burke, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, and Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.